You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And Wisconsin candidates for the U.S. Senate are set to debate tonight, and you can hear it live right here. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7. Listen to an hour of the candidates, plus analysis after it wraps, right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Now, the Biden administration is facing several legal challenges over its proposal to forgive certain student loan debts. This week, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty added another lawsuit on behalf of the Brown County Taxpayers Association. Just yesterday, a federal judge in Green Bay dismissed that suit. We're going to get into the plaintiff's arguments, where the suit goes from here, and then later dissect some of the constitutional issues surrounding the debt consolidation plan. And if you'd like to join us, we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our guest is Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, what was the reason that the Brown County Taxpayers Association filed suit against the president's student debt relief proposal?
Well, what the president has done here is really extraordinary. He has undertaken to wipe out about $1 trillion worth of student debt, adding to the national deficit, without clear congressional authorization. This is a blatant violation of our separation of powers. And it's something that I think the courts need to look at. Now, the problem has been that while a layperson listening to your radio show might think, well, when the president does something that spends money unlawfully, then taxpayers should be able to go to court and sue and have the rightness or wrongness of that adjudicated. But federal courts have been very, very reluctant to ever grant taxpayers standing. They have required a different type of injury to litigants. And so there have been other people who have brought lawsuits. They have tried creative ways around this standing problem. But each time that this has happened, these cases have been filed, the administration has changed the program in order to defeat the standing of the challengers. They do not want to have to defend this action in court because their legal arguments are very, very weak. So we decided to go at it directly, and we're relying on what we admit are some older cases, which recognized certain types of taxpayer standing to challenge a constitutional impropriety in a spending or taxing provision itself. We fully admit that we are asking the law to be used in ways that it hasn't been used recently, but we think in the context of a $1 trillion program, it's very important to the people of this country to have the legality of that program assessed by the courts.
So when Rick,
we're not surprised that, you know, Judge Griesbach said, look, you got to, if you're going to succeed here, you got to take it up to a higher court. It's not something that I can do as a trial judge.
So this is about taxpayers having standing. And generally, from a layperson's perspective, Rick Essenberg, is this because the taxpayers haven't actually paid any money towards this yet, so they don't have standing? Do they have to wait until it becomes a cost for the taxpayer to have a place in the courts for this?
No, it's not that. It's that the federal courts have been reluctant to recognize that type of injury. And so it's in contrast to state courts, where here in Wisconsin, we do have relatively broad taxpayer standing, but federal courts have been somewhat more restrictive. But
so,
it's not a question of whether or not the taxes have been paid already. It's really a question of assessing the type of injury that the plaintiff claims to have suffered.
If you're, and it sounds like you are planning to appeal, correct? The
absolutely.
Okay.
And well, we've already filed an appeal.
All right. So you are appealing. And in the event that you were successful in your appeal, could this change legal precedent about taxpayer standing and federal lawsuits going forward?
Well, we think it would, but only in the narrowest of circumstances, where it would in a case where the challenge is to the action which itself mandated the spending or of money or the taxation of money. It's not simply a question of taxpayers not approving of what the government was doing with their money. We also feel that And we've also argued that the part of the problem here, and sort of borrowing from the West Virginia versus EPA decision last year, that this is really a major question. I mean, this is not something that is sort of a minor dispute about a relatively small amount of money. I mean, this is a huge amount of money. This is a very, very significant unilateral action by the president. You know, one of the things I would caution your listeners is not to form their position with respect to lawsuits like this simply on whether they like student loan forgiveness or not.
You're making a legal argument here, and a legal standing argument, and the role that the president would play, whether it's a unitary executive or still needs some support from the legislature. If the legislature were to support student debt relief and the president were to sign it into law, would the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty have any opportunity to sue?
No, we wouldn't bring the case because the point is not whether student loans should be forgiven or not. I don't think this is a particularly good use of $1 trillion. I think that there's a lot better ways in which that money can be used. But certainly Congress would have the authority to forgive these loans. But it is Congress that has the authority, and not the president acting unilaterally.
Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, joining us. And Rick, one of the arguments I've heard on the president's behalf would be the HEROES Act of 2003, which, as I understand it, provides some authority to the federal government to modify federal student loan programs during national emergencies. And that might include canceling federal student loan debt, or is that Does that give the president any protection as you see it?
Well, no, I don't think so. And of course, neither did the Justice Department until right before the president announced it. It changed its position. The problem is this: the HEROES Act was designed to allow targeted student loan forgiveness for military people and first responders. It was passed in the wake of 9/11, where we knew that there were people who were going to be deployed in various ways, and we didn't want them to default on their student loan. Here you've got a situation where the president is simply saying, well, there was something that happened here that may have made it harder to pay these student loans. They didn't have to actually pay them because we suspended repayment. It's not ongoing now because I've declared that the COVID pandemic to be over. And so it's really an extraordinary expansion that really, I think, goes well beyond what the HEROES Act ever intended. And, last year in the West Virginia case, the Supreme Court made clear that our constitutional separation of powers requires that at least for major questions, and this is a major question, there needs to be clear congressional authorization for executive action. The Congress does not, as the saying goes, hide mountains and molehills. And the notion that something that was passed to accommodate the specific interest of first responders in the wake of a terrorist attack can now be used to allow the president to forgive student loans every time he thinks something that has happened that makes them harder to pay, I think would be a usurpation of the legislative power by the president, and something that nobody should want to permit. Because, even if you love Joe Biden and you love this program and you love the things that he's doing, I guarantee you that at some point in the future, there will be a president who you do not like and who you will not want to have this type of power.
Would you take this case all the way to the Supreme Court?
As
you mentioned, so you would continue to appeal until you get to the very end of our justice system here.
I think that's probably where this is. If this is salient, that's probably where it's going to go.
What about the lawsuit from the six Republican attorneys general, state's attorneys general?
Well, this is an instance where, they tried to work around this standing problem by saying that, look, we have state student loan servicing agencies that are servicing these loans. If you reduce the amount of the loans, those servicing agencies will make less money. And so therefore, we are harmed in a way which goes beyond our status as taxpayers or simply as states. And in response to that, the administration said, okay, we're not going to forgive the loans for the people who are whose debt is being serviced by you, and which is a quite cynical thing, right? Having said that there is this national emergency that requires student loan debt forgiveness for people who meet these certain criteria, it is decided to throw these people under the bus, these people who are having their loans serviced by these six states, in order to prevent the legality of this program from being assessed by a court.
Rick, thanks as always for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Take care.
Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, talking with him about his organization's legal challenge to a federal student loan forgiveness problem program and the dismissal of which they are planning to appeal all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. Joining us now is Eric Casper, professor of political science and pre-law advisor at UW-Eau Claire, where he's also director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And if you would, start by sharing with us why the judge in Green Bay, a federal judge, dismissed Will's lawsuit yesterday, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty.
Yeah, well, if you look at the lawsuit itself, one of the preliminary questions is, do the plaintiffs have standing? And as a general matter, as with the U.S. Constitution, there would need to be, under Article 3 of the Constitution, there would have to be an actual case or controversy, according to the language of Article 3, which includes this requirement then of parties having standing. And so the question is, what is the harm that would be caused? And as was discussed a little bit here earlier in the hour, there are these precedents from the U.S. Supreme Court on taxpayer standing. And the traditional approach from the court back to a case called Frothingham versus Mellon in 1923 is that taxpayers generally do not have standing, and in part because the courts are afraid of, if every question about budgets were then brought into the courts to be litigated constitutionally, that it would overwhelm the courts. There's a major exception that's been found to that over the years, which is that Supreme Court, going back to the 1960s, has found that if their taxpayers are challenging money spent by the government on religious purposes, that under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, they can achieve standing. But Supreme Court has been reluctant to expand taxpayer standing to other areas over the years.
And as we heard from the president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, that he would be willing to take this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is, I would understand it, Eric, could create some new legal precedent. And what would that legal precedent look like were the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty to be successful in their lawsuit?
Well, it depends. If the U.S. Supreme Court decided to revisit some of its case law on taxpayer standing to open up, so to speak, the ability of someone to file a lawsuit as a taxpayer based on their view that the U.S. Constitution is being violated by the spending, it would depend how much they wanted to open it up. They could potentially lay down a rule that makes it so that you could see quite a number of challenges, or they could open it up to just, one other area like they did with the Establishment Clause and allowing taxpayer standing there. In recent years, the majority on the Supreme Court has not sent a signal in any cases that I'm aware of, that they want to see taxpayer standing opened up in that way. And if anything, more recent cases in recent decades from the Supreme Court suggests that if they're going to move in any direction on taxpayer standing at the federal level, it may be to close it up even more. It remains to be seen if they take this case or if they take a number of these cases that are in the courts right now, they could change direction on that question.
Eric Casper, our guest, professor of political science and pre-law advisor at UW-Eau Claire, where he is also the director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. And I want to move past this idea of standing for a moment to get to the question of congressional delegation of authority. I'd asked Rick Eskenberg about the HEROES Act of 2003 and what cover that may provide for the president's plan for student debt relief. Where does the constitutional law put us here?
Yeah, so assuming that you can get past the hurdle of standing, and as you mentioned earlier in the program, there are in terms of what we see in other states in some of these other lawsuits, there are others who are filing lawsuits besides taxpayers. And so even if we don't change the law in terms of taxpayer standing, this case can get potentially into court based on other plaintiffs. I mean, the big question here is, or at least the next big question, is the delegation of authority from Congress to the executive branch. And there is a quite a bit of case law going back two centuries where the Supreme Court has said that Congress does have the ability to delegate some of its authority as long as they provide enough details and they're clear and specific enough with the goals and there are intelligible principles that will guide, in particular, the executive branch of how to exercise that authority. The question here with the HEROES Act then is how do we interpret the language in that act that says this can be done in terms of waiving or modifying the applicable provisions related to student aid programs in the case of a national emergency? What is a national emergency? And that's what, you know, the two parties would be, assuming that we get to the merits of the case, the two parties would be arguing in court whether or not there has been a national emergency as contemplated by the HEROES Act that would allow the executive branch to exercise this power.
Hi, let's go to a phones here at 1-800-642-1234, where Jerry in Illinois is standing by. Jerry, you're on the air with Eric Casper.
Eric, Jerry Podraza, Democratic candidate for Illinois 45th Senate District. My youngsters went to university. My mom provided a Illinois self-funded scholarship, kind of the same kind of program as Wisconsin. I don't have an issue about this because I hear these attorneys tripping all over themselves with this constitutional noise. Here's the bottom line on this, I feel. For 10 years, if you look back at your checking account statement, your credit card statement, your savings account statement, we were getting paid 0.25%, 0.5% on those investments for years. The credit card statements were skyrocketing, 18-20%. The individuals that had student loans during that time were paying a high interest.
And I appreciate the call, Jerry. We're short on time, but that doesn't seem to have entered into the debate or at least legal discussion of what's happening here, Eric.
Well, I think it's important to point out the distinction between, you know, the policy question, does what happens here, is it good or bad policy versus is it constitutional? And I mean, that, as I was pointed out earlier in the hour, if Congress were to pass something that the president signed into law to do this exact same thing, then that delegation of power question wouldn't be there. This is really the only question is, if Congress doesn't act to do something, can the executive branch now act on its own to do this? But I mean, to the caller's point, you know, with those real concerns about student debt that have arisen over the years, I mean, that in and of itself could be reason for Congress to take action. But if Congress doesn't take action, then what is constitutional for the executive branch to do without Congress doing something new? They would have to rely on some sort of authority here that's been delegated by Congress in the past.
And Eric, going back to the HEROES Act for a moment, which has been used at least by some legal scholars as a cover for the president's proposal for some student debt relief, how have the courts seen the scope of the HEROES Act and what it can and can't do?
Well, I'm not aware of application here to this specific question in terms of the you know, what we're looking at in terms of this type of student debt relief. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, the definition of a national emergency, it's like a lot of other terms that get used in the law. You know, if you could define that, I think, as the way the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are defining it, this is not the equivalent of some sort of post 9/11 or kind of wartime situation. But because the language does have a little bit of subjectivity in it, I'm sure that, you know, the government on the defense on this lawsuit would point to the fact that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic was quite an unprecedented
period of time, and that you saw a major disruption to our, you know, our way of life and to people's employment and their finances in many cases. And so that's why they're making the argument, and we're seeing this in some of the lower courts now and other places around the country, that it does fit that notion of a national emergency.
Hey, Eric, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Casper is professor of political science and pre-law advisor at UW-Eau Claire, where he's also director of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. We talked with him about the dismissal of Will's lawsuit challenging the Biden administration's student loan debt forgiveness plan and what sort of legal standing the president might have to get that plan pushed through. And we also looked at some of the constitutional challenges that the plan's been facing. I want to invite you to continue the conversation all weekend long, if you like, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. And let us know what you think about the president's proposal, what taxpayers standing have, what taxpayers have in terms of standing in the courts, and whether or not you can see the constitutional arguments being made for and against and the potential consequences of what could come with new legal precedents as a result of this case. Democrats are doing pretty well in the polls for this year's midterms, but can those polls be trusted? Over the last few years, polls have overestimated Democrats and underestimated Republican votes. That was the case in 2020, infamously in 2016, and in some cases in 2018 as well. So what does that portend for 2022? It's unclear if there's actually a systemic bias in favor of Democrats or if other factors are at play here. Polling, after all, is inherently imprecise. So we're talking about polling ahead of the 2022 midterms, and we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you trust those polls? Have you ever responded to an election poll, or have you ever turned away from one? You think polls are biased in favor of Democrats? 1-800-642-1234, or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Samara Klar is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Government and Public Policy. Samara, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So I'm curious, there is some talk that perhaps Democrats could maintain the majority in the House. They could hold on to a slim majority in the Senate. But as mentioned, the polls in recent past have seemed to overestimate Democratic support. So I'm curious how you're applying election polling data to your expectations of the midterm elections, which are now 31 days away.
Sure. I mean, it's a stressful time to be a pollster because the polls are so tight, especially in a state like Arizona, where I'm speaking to you from. And it's true. If we think about recent presidential elections, so, you know, 2020, 2016, what really hits people is the sort of surprise performance by Republicans. Now, a lot of people don't realize that the 2020 polls were actually more biased towards Democrats than were 2016. The 2016 polls weren't all that bad nationally. They actually came out very, very accurate when it came to sort of the national popular vote. However, there was a few states, and you're in one of them, where the polling really overestimated support for Democrats. In 2016, we saw a similar pattern where, I'm sorry, in 2020, we saw a similar pattern, but it was actually quite a bit more dramatic. Biden was predicted to win by a lot more than he did. The reason I think people think mostly about 2016 when it comes to sort of bad polls was that although it was a very small error, it was unfortunately predicting the wrong winner. And that's what people really remember. 2020 polls predicted the correct winner, but by a lot more than he actually won by. So that's why people are a little nervous when they're thinking about, or Democrats at least, are a little nervous when they're looking towards 2022 and then 2024 as well. But, you know, if you look more sort of at a further back in history, more than just the past 4 years or 8 years, polls are not consistently in favor of Democrats. They don't typically bias towards Democrats every year over time. It swings back and forth. For example, the 2012 polls actually overestimated support for Republicans. 2012 seems like, you know, light years, you know, eons ago politically, but, you know, we're talking about a decade ago. So I don't know if we can say that polls are consistently consistently overestimating support for Democrats. There was a little bit of variation there.
But most recently, it seems as though they've trended towards overestimating Democratic support. And what is the what's the imprecision in this? Is it sample? Is it, you talk about 2012, I think about the number of cell phones I've had since 2012. Is it technology? Is it sample? Samara, what do you think is going on in the discrepancy there?
Sure. The discrepancy seems largely attributed to what we call selection bias, which is who is actually agreeing to participate in these polls at all. And typically what we find is that for whatever reason, and we could talk about a lot of theories as to why this is, Republicans are less interested in actually responding to pollsters. So Democrats or liberal Americans are much more likely to respond to polls. And at the end of the day, pollster is going to see who responded to the polls. They're doing their best to get as nationally representative of a sample as possible, but you can't force people to do it. It's voluntary. It's an altruistic thing. And just a quick thank you to any listener of yours who does respond to polls, because we love you. But some people don't do it, and Republicans are especially unlikely to do it. So a pollster has to take the data that they get, and what they do is they weight the data. So they try to make responses from Republicans or responses from certain types of people who are underrepresented in the poll count for more than responses from the types of people who are overrepresented. And the less representative the sample, the harder it is to do that well. So it comes down exactly to what you say, to sample, to who is actually participating in these polls.
And how are these participants in these polls being contacted these days? The old landline seems to be a thing of the past.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I always tell my students, it's not actually cell phones that killed the polls. It's call display. Call display is what, and, my college students, they were not, ever since they were born, they know about call display. The idea that when I was a kid, the phone would ring and you genuinely didn't know who
it was
is baffling to them. Yes. You don't know if it's your best friend, if it's your spouse, if it's a pollster, you just don't know. So call display has been an issue. It's not necessarily cell phones, because pollsters can access cell phones, as many cell phone users can attest. So these days, what pollsters are increasingly doing are relying on online samples. And these are not probability based, meaning they are recruiting people who are joining survey panels, who agree that they will take surveys as they come in via email, text message. They are advertising on social media platforms. They are sort of trying to reach people in whatever way they can. And then they are weighting their data after the fact to try to get something that appears to be a more of a nationally representative sample of the population.
Samara Klar, our guest, a political scientist at the University of Arizona. And interested, if you've taken a poll recently in the as we reach towards the upcoming midterm elections, 1-800-642-1234. How much faith you put in those polls when you hear them in the news? And what stock you put in them, and whether or not it changes your behavior as you go to the ballot box. 1-800-642-1234. And Samara Klar, do you think this recent history of overestimating Democrats is a sign of systemic bias?
Well, the thing that pollsters are trying to do when it comes to pre-election polling is they're trying to figure out two things. The first is, what do Americans today think about the candidates? And polls are actually really terrific at figuring that out. We're good as pollsters at measuring the public mood or measuring what people believe today. The impossible task of pre-election polling is predicting who is actually going to vote. Mm. And if you ask somebody, are you going to vote? Odds are they're going to say yes, because people want to vote. They see themselves as voters. They're planning on voting. But I can tell you there has been an election in the recent past I didn't vote for because I was traveling. I couldn't find my absentee ballot. Things happen. So that's the challenge here. Now, I don't know for sure that the polls are overestimating support in either direction. There is some reason to believe that potentially Republicans have become less likely to respond to polls because of their growing distrust in what you would call the mainstream media. And we did see that grow, of course, with Donald Trump's sort of, very regular attacks against the media. But even in the years preceding Donald Trump, there's sort of this diverging trust in the media between Republicans and Democrats. And it's leading Republicans, it seems, to be less likely to comply with academics, to comply with media. When, NBC News polling calls a Republican person, they may be less likely to want to give them their time. Completing a poll is, after all, as I said, it's an altruistic thing to do. Respondents aren't getting anything. They're not getting paid. It doesn't help them at all. they're just charitably giving up their time. And the less faith you have in media or academia or whoever it is that's contacting you, the less likely you might want to be to help them out. And I think that's had a big effect on why we're seeing Republicans as less interested in participating in polls. If that holds up, then yes, I would expect to see a little bit of over support for Democratic candidates, as we've seen in recent years.
So, Samara, then, is it the job of the pollster then to try to figure out which Republicans are not participating in the polling and then weigh the poll in a way that would acknowledge that they exist without necessarily getting their data from them directly? And that leads to some imprecision in these polling, especially when you underscore that everybody's going to say they want to go vote, but whether it's available to them on the election day is another matter.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So you have to look at your data and sort of stratify it by all these demographics. So, you know, what proportion of my respondents have graduated from college? What proportion of my respondents have a graduate degree? You try to look at where they live, their income. You can ask them things like, have you voted in the past? Which I will tell you is also not an entirely accurate response. But you're trying to figure out who is in my sample relative to the types of people who typically vote. Because remember, another challenge of pre-election polling is we're not trying to match our sample to the American public. We're trying to match our sample to the voting public. And we might have great demographic statistics from the U.S. Census on the broad American public, but we have far less precise demographics about the people who actually turn out to vote. And that's the population we're trying to replicate.
We're talking with University of Arizona political scientist Samara Klar about election polling and what they get right and what they may miss. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Do you think polls are helpful? Are there better ways to understand what Americans are thinking about their politicians and how they plan to cast their ballot? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Email is always available to you, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation about 2022 midterm polling and whether it's repeating a big mistake of the recent past and overestimating Democratic support. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Samara Klar, and she is the political scientist at University of Arizona, joining us this half hour. And Samara, you'd mentioned before that polling has been pretty good, pretty spot on when it comes to public and opinion polling, but it can be, you know, give or take when it comes to election polling. This is something that was also reiterated by a Pew Research Center, as well as the director of our Marquette Law School poll, Charles Franklin. Why is it that we get public opinion so right, but we can get elections so wrong?
Well, you know, it's a lot easier to ask people their beliefs and measure them than it is to try to predict their future behavior. So public opinion polls can tell us what people think today about an issue. And that's what polls are meant to do. Polls are not really meant to be these crystal balls that try to predict who's going to mail in their ballot, who's going to show up at the ballot booth, so on and so forth. So it's that element of predictive behavior in pre-election polling that is so challenging. Trying to measure which candidates people like today is actually quite good. And it's really important to think about polls as sort of a measure of public mood over time to see how people are feeling about candidates. Polls can help us see trends in approval of candidates or favorability ratings. But the best pre-election polling is going to be the poll that takes place as close to the election day as possible. That would be the pre-election polls that I would see as most reliable.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. We'll start with Kay in Madison. Kay, good afternoon. You're on the air with Samara Klar.
Hi. I had took part in a poll a few weeks ago, and all the time I was answering questions, I was thinking to myself, now, is this legitimate? Is this a scam? You know, I'm more than happy to take part in a poll, but when you get so many other kind of phone calls where people are trying to ask you information,
you feel like
sell me something.
Yeah, you feel like a phone call can be a potential scam, and I feel that way too, especially if you don't know where it's coming from. And before we get Samara's reaction to Kay and Madison, let's go to Tom in Green Bay. Tom, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how do we spot a push pull as soon as possible? I get some of these calls where, you know, they start out nice but by the third or fourth question, they're pushing, you know, so-and-so, are you in favor of their liberal ideas or are you in favor of their conservative ideas?
It's a couple of calls back-to-back about the legitimacy of those pollsters once they contact the public. Samara, how can we know that what we're getting or what we're participating in is legitimate?
Yeah, these are both great questions. So push polls are technically, you know, illegal in many states. And for those of you who don't know what a push poll is sort of a fake poll that's being conducted typically by a campaign or by someone associated with a campaign, the intent of which is actually not to measure public opinion at all, but is rather to persuade. So it's almost like a commercial being delivered to you in the guise of a poll. There are a couple ways that you can quite easily figure out whether or not you are being exposed to a push poll or a real poll. First of all, push polls are far shorter than actual surveys. A push poll will typically less than a minute. It's usually 4 or 5 questions. They have no desire to actually measure your opinion. They're just trying to get an opinion across. A survey will go on, sadly, affect the response rate a little bit, but they can last, you know, 10 minutes or so because they're actually trying to get a lot of data. So if you have a poll coming in, they're just rapid firing a couple questions at you, and the questions are containing more information than they are question, it's probably a push poll. The other thing I will say is that surveys are required to disclose at the beginning of the survey who is providing the information, who this is coming from. If you have a survey coming through and they're not telling you what organization is funding this or who this is coming from, you have every right to hang up the phone because you deserve to know at the beginning of that survey where this information is coming from. And any transparent survey researcher will provide that to you.
Samara, you'd mentioned before about the underreporting that Republicans have done most recently and how that has led to some overestimations of Democratic election results. And one of the reasons you gave is distrust of the mainstream media. Is there, and one of the things the mainstream media does when they report on polls is not report on the margin of error. That margin of error many times can put a poll that makes it look like one candidate's ahead into a statistical dead heat. Are we doing a disservice by not mentioning the error, range of error that's available in these pollings?
Oh, yes, that breaks my heart when I see that. When I see sort of, you know, Joe Smith is up ahead beating John Jones and you look at it and it's a margin of error of 3 percentage points and Joe Smith is up by 1%. It's like, oh no. But yes, that's exactly right. You know, and the American Association of Public Opinion Research has a series of standards that pollsters are supposed to abide by in order to be considered, frankly, scientific surveys. And one of them is to always report your sample size, report your methods, report your margin of error. I think the journalists typically do a pretty good job. I like to think that journalists have quite a lot of skill in learning how to read these polls and put out correct information. But yes, sometimes you see these just terribly cringy headlines where a statistical tie is being portrayed as some sort of, you know, this guy's up or that woman's down. And you're exactly right. You want to look at the margin of error and see how much of a statistical difference is there actually between these two candidates. In the state that I'm talking to you from, Arizona, we've got a gubernatorial race where I have not seen a poll that shows any statistically significant difference between our two candidates in weeks.
Samara Clara, our guest, she is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Government and Public Policy, and you are invited to join us at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike in Milwaukee is standing by. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
I've had a problem for a long time with polls, and here it is. People do not want to vote for losers. They want to vote for winners. So when they pay attention to polls, their opinion changes based on what the polls are saying.
So you think the polls are actually influencing the results of the election here, Mike, and that there's a bandwagon effect taking place where people see the polls in the news and then get on that popular bandwagon. Is there anything to that, Samara?
Yeah, I think that Mike raises a really great question that honestly political scientists have spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out, and that's whether, you know, polls can actually lead opinion. And there are scholars that do find some effects of that. You know, typically people don't want to waste their vote. We see that. That's sort of why third party candidates have such a tough uphill climb. So, you know, is it true that these horse race polls are guiding opinion? I think absolutely there is some of that going on. And some people question, you know, whether we should even have horse race polls at all. You know, a horse race poll is simply one that says which guy's up, which woman's down, who's where. Is that contributing to what we know about Americans' concerns about the issues that are important to them, about the policies that they support or that they oppose? No, some people argue that this is sort of an entertainment part of politics. At best, it's a distraction. At worst, it can actually, guide opinion. I will say, in the context of a general election, particularly in contemporary American politics, where we have two parties that are quite clearly distinct from one another, the likelihood that somebody would switch votes is small. But Mike's correct. People just might not turn out. If they see that the party they prefer is not doing well, there is a chance they might not come out at all. And, you know, I think that was a risk in 2016, frankly, when we had polls saying that Hillary Clinton was 95% going to win. There's absolutely some potential that Hillary Clinton voters said, well, you know what, there's probably not much point in me turning out after all. So I think the lesson here is you should vote regardless. I mean, if you want to pay attention to the polls, you're welcome to. I do think that, you know, it's not wrong to look to the polls for some guidance. If some people, you know, are curious to see what most voters are doing, that's fair. Some people might be actually, you know, find that to be useful information. But you should vote based on your, you know, on your values, on your preferences, and don't necessarily think you're going to waste your vote, because you never know.
And Samara Klar, what can we do to make our polling more precise?
You can respond to polls.
wait, this is on me now. I've got to do this.
It's your fault. The truth is, polls are a collaborative effort on the part of all voters. And the more that we participate, the more accurate they're going to be. And I tell my undergrads this all the time. I'm like, how many of you have ever responded to a poll? And they're like, yeah, no, I've never done that. And I'm like, come on, guys, help out here. But it's true. Participating in polls is the only thing we can really do to improve their quality. And also, you know, reading them closely, following them, and understanding, you know, what those statistics mean.
Samara, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great talking with you.
Samara Klar is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Government and Public Policy, talking with us about polling in the 2022 midterms, which are now 31 days away.